The following is an exclusive presentation of WI Garden Media, the voice of Garden Talk Radio.
Coming up on the program today, we're going to discuss how you can grow successful tomatoes in your backyard, as well as the life cycle of soil. Our guest is master food preserver and podcaster Jennifer Gomes will be with us, and we'll answer your garden questions. The hour is full, so join us.
You are listening to the most informationally packed hour of garden-focused radio in the country and on the internet with your host, husband and wife team Joey and Holly Baird. This is the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
And welcome to another edition of the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Happy to have you along. Thank you for taking time out of your day to join us. I am your host, Joey Baird. Beside me is my wife, co-host, best friend, and gardening partner,
Holly Baird.
This program is for you, about you, to help your garden grow better, to maintain your landscape, grow healthier trees, make your grass look greener, as well as preserving what you grow. Happy you're tuning in, whether you're doing such on one of the 18 AM and FM frequencies broadcasting our program here, Season 8 in 2024, through our radio app, through our parent website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, underneath the Season 8 tab at the top of the page. Maybe you're capturing it in podcast replay or in-studio video replay. However you're doing it, thank you. You want to be part of the program, participation is welcome. Give us a call, toll-free, coast-to-coast at 1-800-927-SHOW. That's 1-800-927-7469. Or an email at gardentalkradio@gmail.com. That's gardentalkradio@gmail.com. All right, Holly, before we get in the program, it's time for this week's Joke of the Week.
Okay, so I think I saw Michael J. Fox at the Garden Center yesterday, but I'm not sure if it was him because he had his Back to the Fuchsia.
There you go. This week's garden joke is sponsored by Rescue.com.
American-made rescue products keep your family home and yard protected from pests like insects, like wasps, hornets, yellow jackets, flies, ants, and more. Learn more at Rescue.com. That's R-E-S-C-U-E.com.
Well, it's time to start, and many people have in certain areas begin to start tomatoes indoors. But how to grow the best tomatoes? Most people, if they garden at all, they're going to grow at least a tomato on their patio, porch, deck in a container. Some people grow hundreds of them. Some people grow a few. We have grown tomatoes since we've started gardening before we met and during our tenure together. And we're going to go over some of the techniques in which we have...
Did you say our tenure together?
Yeah.
Who taught you that word?
I learned some stuff. I know it's amazing that I know some things about some stuff. I know it shocks you. So some of the techniques that we have learned and adapted and has worked for us in our starting seeds to harvest technique for growing tomatoes.
Do you want to hear how Joey won me over?
Let's hear it. Love story here.
Okay, so the first summer that we were dating, you would bring me just all these cherry tomatoes, and I would eat them as snacks when I was working. And I thought about you, and you bring me the cherry tomatoes, and that's our love story. There's more to it than that, but it helps.
So there is some things in which we want to start or start seeds with. Now, we can either start our seeds indoors, or we can buy them. And typically, we talked about this last week, if you buy your starts, which there's nothing wrong with that, you're going to have a more limited variety than if you are able to start them and get your seeds, let's say, from JungSeed.com, where they have multiple varieties and dozens instead of a few. You can start them indoors approximately 6 to 8 weeks before your last average frost date, and you put them on a south-facing window or in under a grow light, and you can get them started that way. Or what we will begin doing this year, as we experimented last year with, Holly grew up this way, where we just plant the seeds directly in the ground at the time that we planted the transplants in the ground. And by the end of the season and throughout the season during fruit bearing time, they had the equal amount of fruit bearing at the same time. So we didn't have to start. We don't have to start dozens indoors and take up a space that you may not have. You can direct sow your seeds in the ground just like you would lettuce or spinach or radishes. You don't have to do tomato plant transplants. And my recommendation would be, unless you're using fresh seeds that you bought this year, put 2 seeds in each hole at the time of planting when you do your tomatoes.
Right. So then you, when you're ready to start your seeds.
Let's go back a little bit here.
When you're ready to put them in the ground, I think.
Seed or start.
Yeah. I think at this point we can get to that now. You want to make sure that you look at the long range forecast. And also, if you have to wait a week, wait a week. And you want to make sure your soil temp is about 70 degrees, 65 to 80 is ideal. And so when you want to check your soil temp, what you do is you take like your meat thermometer. I think they probably have soil thermometers.
But meat thermometer works fine.
Put it where you would put the roots of the tomato plant and then see what it is. If it's below, definitely if it's below 65, you want to hold off. You want to make sure your soil temp is going to stay pretty consistently above 65 degrees.
Yes. Wait. If you have to, because it's no worse than you plant it and then everything dies and you got to replant it again, 2 weeks later. So when you plant your plant, you want to bury your plant 3/4 of the way. Now, this is if you don't do seed. If you do seed, this is not applicable to you. If you are starting starts and you plant your starts or you buy them and you put them in and you plant them, you want to plant them about 3/4 of the way up the plant.
Now, you can't do this with all plants. Tomatoes are part of the nightshade family. And if you look at a tomato plant and you see these fine little hairs on the stem, you can even just feel them. Those are all possibility of roots. So when you can bury them deep because of that possibility of roots, or they will become roots.
Peppers it doesn't work on. Yeah. Eggplants it doesn't work on. Tomatoes are a unique species here.
So you want to keep that in mind, that you can bury them deeper, and that allows them to gain roots and pick up nutrients and grow happily.
So when you plant it deep, you want to remove everything except for the stem itself, the offshoots or the branches below soil grade. You want to snip them off, not tear them off, cut them off. And that's going to eliminate some of the potential issues your plant will have while those fibrous hairs are developing into roots. Now, you want good, well-draining soil. You want good, rich soil. People say, what do you put in the hole at the time of planting? Everybody's got every million different concoctions. You just need water and good compost. That's really all you need. You don't need Tums. You don't need powdered milk. You don't need eggshells. We had Robert Polavis on the program the first week.
The Mythbuster.
Garden Mythbuster. If you're going to use Tums, you got to use 80 per plant, assuming that you have low calcium. Eggshells take 18 months to break down to a usable form, and you're not going to have enough calcium in an eggshell or eggshells. Powdered milk, waste of time. There's so many of these things in which we've done that are not worth doing because they have no significant or any effect whatsoever on the plant. People put that stuff in the hole at the time of planting because that will fix blossom end rot. Blossom end rot is a calcium deficiency for the root of the fruit development, because it cannot access the calcium, which is already in the soil because the soil is too dry because you're not watering it. People say put Epsom salt measurement of Epsom salt in 1 gallon in water. You're watering.
Epsom salt is not calcium.
It's magnesium sulfate. Yeah.
And a lot of people, so what happens is, as Joey had mentioned, when they put the Epsom salt in, they water it in, you know, they put it on their plant, or maybe just kind of cultivate it into around the plant, the soil, and then they water it. And then when that happens,
They're watering the plant. Which is releasing the calcium in which the plant needs. So in the next set of fruit it puts on, it will have the accessible amount of calcium in order to finish developing the fruit, so you don't have the black and sunken portion of the bottom of the tomato. So at the time of planting, you want to early blight is a form of a soil disease that, when splashed up on your leaves, will begin to kill your tomato plant off from the bottom up. So there's 3 steps in which you can eliminate or greatly reduce the effects of what early blight has on your tomatoes. 1, at the time of planting, put 1 handful of yellow whole grain cornmeal around the base of the plant. You don't have to mix it in. Just throw it on top of the soil. water it. You don't have to worry about it. That yellow whole grain cornmeal has a beneficial bacteria in it called Trichoderma, which fights that early blight. We've done this since 2014. Bob Webster, a master gardener out of Texas and a Garden Talk radio host, we found him online. He told it, you know, everybody to do this. We thought, why not? Nothing else is working, and it's worked phenomenal. Additionally, you want to mulch some type of natural material around the base of the plant to also put a barrier between soil and plant, so when it rains or you water, splash up is minimal to none. Thirdly, trim the lower 6 to 8 inches of your plant. Leave the stem, but trim off any additional outshoots from that ground level up 6 to 8 inches. Anything from the canopy that is draping down, snip it off. Prevent that soil from splashing up on it. By doing these steps, you're going to have a lot better tomato crop than you've ever had before. Additionally, we want to stake our plants.
You want to stake support your tomato plants. You want to get them off the ground, whether that be using tomato cages from the store, using two, you know, old pieces of spare plywood or whatever, or 2x4s or what have you, and using tying them, or you can do something what we call the Florida weave, where you take posts on either end of the garden bed, and then you run two strings across at about 1 foot heights along the way, and then that way you can kind of have the tomatoes staked between those strings. But any way you can have them off the ground is very helpful. It keeps them, obviously, from having water splashing up on them. And it also is easier to pick. It gives them nice air circulation around there, prevents them from rotting, prevents, you know, some of these insects from eating them as easily. So it's really helpful to stake them.
50% of your crop will be lost if you do not stake your tomatoes, cherry, or beefsteak. It doesn't matter. Get them up off the ground. So that is just some of the early season tricks and tips and techniques in which can get your tomatoes up and going and better and more productive than you've ever had them before, whether you have 50 in the ground, 20 in containers, or a few on a porch, patio, or deck. Throughout the season here, the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show, we will continue to add segments of how to do this with your tomatoes at this time of year, how to do that. So if you want more information, you can go to our parent website, which is thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. And in the search bar in the upper right corner, type in tomatoes. And there will be dozens of videos on very specific how to do this or how to do that or maintaining tomatoes based on what period of growth your tomatoes currently are at this time of year.
So we are brought to you today by our sponsor, Walton's Inc. We know you care about where your food comes from. Canning and preserving your fruits and vegetables is great. But what about the meat? At waltonsinc.com, you can get the equipment, seasoning, and supplies to make sausage, jerky, and any other meat product your way to your high standards. Do you want to make some snack sticks that people will actually like? Walton's created meatgistics.com, an informational site to help you make the best finished product. Walton's even has a full line of their own meat grinders, mixers, sausage stuffers, and more to help you go from animal to edible. Walton's, everything but the meat. Use code GROW50 to save 10% off your orders of $50 or more.
That's GROW50 to save 50 what was it?
10% off your orders of $50 or more.
At waltonsinc.com. Hang out with us when we come back. Life of your garden soil. You're tuned in to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Have a garden question? Give Joey and Holly a call now or anytime 24/7. Just dial 1-800-927-SHOW. If you can't get through, leave a message and they will call you back. Call now, 1-800-927-SHOW.
Jung Seed Company is a family-owned and operated seed company since 1907 with the largest selection of seeds and plants online. Use coupon code 10TG24 to save 10% off your order at jungseed.com. The coupon code is 10TG24 at jungseed.com for 10% off.
Blue Ribbon Organics, providing locally made organic compost and soil blends for gardeners, farms, landscaping, and more. To find our products nearest you, visit BlueRibbonOrganics.com. If you could double the life of your raised bed boxes by sealing the wood with a clear non-toxic wood preservative, would you? Well, now you can with a clear, penetrating product called Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's 100% non-toxic and easy to apply. Seal your untreated wood surfaces, even chicken coops, by spraying on Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's invisible, seals the wood from the inside out, and never wears off. Recommended by organic gardening experts, Internal Wood Stabilizer. Check it out at TimberProCoatingsUSA.com. Have insects such as aphids or fungal gnats invaded your plants? Fight back with Summit Year-Round Spray Oil and Summit Mosquito Bits. Organic Summit Year-Round Spray Oil kills insect pests on indoor and outdoor plants. All natural mosquito bits kill fungal gnats, larvae, in container plants. Both products are harmless to people, plants, and wildlife. Summit Year-Round Spray Oil and Summit Mosquito Bit are available at garden centers, hardware stores, and at SummitResponsibleSolutions.com.
Dig planting holes from a comfortable standing position. Step, twist, pull, and plant. Visit ProPlugger.com.
Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Life of your soil moments away, but first, honeybee healthy.
Since 2000, Honeybee Healthy Inc. has helped beekeepers maintain healthy and thriving hives. Attracting pollinators to your garden this year is as simple as hanging a hummingbird feeder with a mixture of sugar and water and Honeybee Healthy Original. Don't be alarmed to see birds, bees, and butterflies dining together at the feeder. Pollinators coexist peacefully. Honeybee Healthy is offering a 10% discount on an 8-ounce bottle of Honeybee Healthy Original to the show's listeners. Enter code BEEGARDEN, that's B-E-E Garden, at checkout. For information and more, you can go to honeybeehealthy.com. That's honey, the letter B, healthy.com.
Your soil is alive. That's why your garden grows. In the big ag industry, soil is dead. It's sprayed with chemicals, and it's a medium for the plants to grow in, and to then they pump the chemicals into the plant and the fertilizer. We do things differently in the backyard.
Right. So, but I just want to talk about what soil is made out of, basically.
Okay.
And also, yeah, just what soil is made of. And there's also different layers to your soil. So the parent materials of soil, what soil is made out of, is anything from rocks, which rocks are then broken down by weathering, erosion, water, wind, temperature change, gravity, chemical interaction, living organisms, pressure differences, all break that down. And as it's being broken down, it also, things are incorporated, like natural materials like leaves, plant life, whatever. And then there are living organisms in your soil. So that is natural bacteria, decomposers. There's little microscopic decomposers. There's larger decomposers like worms, beetles.
Grubs.
Grubs.
And those animals die and they become part of the soil as well. Yeah.
So it's a whole continual web in a way, and also just a whole continual cycle that goes on and on. So it can be all of those things. And over time, the soil will lose some of the parent material. The old soil, the soil that's not as alive, will often erode away or get blown away in the wind, what have you. So it's a whole
Cycle,
yeah. Whatever.
And Holly has a degree in this. That's why she is so fluent in this description of what soil is.
Yeah, and so there's a whole profile. So if you were looking at if you stuck a cylinder down in the soil and took like a cross section of that, the first layer, the top layer, is the horizon, which is the humus rich topsoil where you grow things. That's going to be the highest in the organic matter, where the biological activity is the highest, like plant roots growing, earthworms, insects, microorganisms, active, thriving. And so that's the A horizon. The B horizon is the subsoil, which is often clay. And this is less fertile than the topsoil, but holds more moisture. And it is generally like a lighter color. Like if you ever dig down in your soil, you'll have like that darker, hopefully, you'll have the darker topsoil. And then if you dig deeper, you'll find this lighter color soil or clay-like soil typically. And then there's the underlying weathered rock where a lot of times that will break down and come to the top. So it's always moving around, always shifting. And a lot of earthworms, because they go down to 8 feet down into your soil, bring that back up to the surface.
It continues to cycle it around. And so there's a lot of different activity and a lot of different items moving about in order to get your soil fertile and healthy. And in nature, not by us making compost in our backyard, but in nature, you go to the forest, it takes between 100 and 1,000 years, based on different charts online, to create 1 inch of topsoil. So that's a long time in order for the leaves and the pine needles and the tree debris to drop and to rot and to biodegrade and the microbes and all that to do what it needs to do in order to build that 1 inch of topsoil. That's a long time, 100 to 500 to 1,000 years.
It does. It does take a long time, and it's continually happening. And
but in our backyards, we can do this in a rapid progression.
But if you think about it, you know, Joey and I were talking about mulch, and you're like, okay, enough with the mulch already. But if you've ever
mulch is your friend.
If you ever veered off, you know, even just at your local park and looked into the more forested areas, you will see that you're not going to see bare soil. You're going to see leaves, which act as a mulch, or even like evergreen branches that have fallen down, things like that, or regular branches.
Or in an area where things don't grow very good, you're going to have trash weeds or trash trees, something covering and holding that soil in place.
Trash trees. Yep. Yeah. So, yeah. And so there's a lot of things that are breaking down, and it's below what you may think is going on, and you might think, well, it's just dirt, but it's not dirt. It's a living, breathing thing that's going on. And I mean, I could do probably a whole segment about worms, but worms have a huge factor in this. So if you are ever like, I never see worms, you know, when I'm digging in my garden, if you mulch, you will find worms, because worms will come where the food is. They'll find that food. If you add compost, they'll find that compost. If you build it, they will come.
Right.
If you give them something to eat, they will show up. And worms, they won't overpower themselves. They'll kind of take over the space as they need to, and they're not going to reproduce too much where they won't have enough food. They're very smart.
Absolutely. And you don't have to bring worms in. Oh, by the way, dirt is dead. Soil is alive, if you want to look at the true meaning of those. You don't have to add worms. People say, well, I'll just add worms to my raised bed. I'll just add worms to my garden. Don't do that. You're introducing something different into your ecosystem. In a raised bed, you don't have to add anything, because you've brought in very good soil that you don't need to have worms do anything to it. If you put your beds on top of the native soil, then worms will find their way up into your raised bed. Containers don't add worms. Don't add worms to grow bags. It doesn't need it, and it's a whole nother mess that you're introducing that you don't need problems for.
And it's one thing to consider also, if you ever decide to, you know, maybe purchase a new home or move somewhere and you want to grow a garden, you would have to look at the topography of where you're moving to. Sometimes, you know, you might find a place that's on a slight hill, and that could cause soil erosion faster because you have an incline or a decline. Or if you move to one of these brand new subdivisions that doesn't maybe have good soil yet, that's been building over time, or that somebody put just a layer of topsoil over whatever, you may have to invest in raised beds.
Soil tests from SoilSavvy.com will also tell you what you need to know if you're moving to a new place and you don't know what the soil is like, or you know what's going on in your backyard and you need to figure out why things are so out of whack. They will tell you in that soil test.
Right. And if you live in an area where there's a lot of clay, which occurs in many areas of where, especially where the glaciers came through, and where the glaciers didn't come through, there might be sand. So you have these two subsoils where even near the topsoil, where you might not have a lot of opportunity for very fertile soil, you do have options, again, like raised beds, straw bale, just even like some nice container gardening, or grow bags.
There you go. So your soil is alive, and there's a lot of things in which we do that can damage it, and there's a lot of things in which we can do to help it along.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing you can always do is add more organic material. So that could be anything from like coffee grounds to your kitchen scraps to leaves to if you have some straw. That will all break down over time. That will feed those worms, feed those other organisms. If you find mushrooms growing in your backyard, don't freak out. It means that you have some sort of healthy ecosystem going on. Just don't let your kids or your pets eat them. Don't eat them yourself. And let them do their thing. But
you can also, if you don't want to compost, you can also do trench composting, meaning like dig a trench like you're going to plant potatoes, put your compost in a place in which you're not going to plant this year, cover it up, and the next year plant on top of where that stuff was and that you buried, and it'll be very nutrient-rich soil for your tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and so on.
That's always a great option as well.
Soon it will be warming up, Holly, and we want to make sure that we can enjoy our yard without sharing it with those Japanese beetles and grubs.
Yeah, with spring, you know, pretty much here, it's time to start thinking about those grubs in your garden yard, controlling them, etc. You know, before you know it, you're going to be out in the backyard, chilling, relaxing, grilling, whatever you got going on. And there's, of course, you know, those Japanese beetles. Your neighbor's probably going to come over while you're grilling, give you, you know, have some chit-chat and talk about those Japanese beetles.
Grub Gone can be applied directly to the turf or garden around ornamentals and to control those grubs and lessen the impact those beetles will have on your yard this summer. Easy to apply with any commercial spreader or irrigate right into the soil. Specifically designed to control the targeted grubs, beetles, and invaders without harming those beneficial insects such as bees, ladybugs, and butterflies.
And to be honest, it's the only non-chemical that works. You can find out more at phylumbioproducts.com. That's P-H-Y-L-L-O-M bioproducts.com.
Hang out with us. Jennifer Gome, master canner and podcaster, will be with us right after this. You're tuned into the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show.
Got a question for Joey and Holly? Send it via email anytime to gardentalkradio@gmail.com.
Goodbye biting bugs and plant invaders. No More Bugs by Naturally Green Products is your answer. No More Bugs is DEET-free and not sticky on your skin. USDA certified, No More Bugs has been a favorite by consumers across the country for over 14 years. More than a repellent, it is safe for you and your plants, pets, and home. Available online at nomorebugs.net, Amazon, Walmart.com, and the Home Shopping Network. Pomona's Universal Pectin is a high-quality pectin that gels reliably with low amounts of any sweetener. If you're trying to reduce the amount of sugar in your diet, you'll love Pomona's Universal Pectin. Now you can make healthy homemade jams and jellies sweetened to your taste. You can use sugar or honey to sweeten. Pomona's Universal Pectin keeps indefinitely when stored in an airtight container. Easy to use, versatile, and comes with directions and recipes in every box. Find out more and where to buy at PomonaPectin.com. Also available at natural food stores and online. Make watering easy. DripWorks provides quality drip irrigation supplies and equipment to gardeners just like you for all your growing needs across the U.S. and Canada. Purchase online at DripWorks.com. Happy 65th anniversary to David J. Frank, Southeastern Wisconsin's leading landscape company. Their award-winning services include everything from lawn care, landscape maintenance, design, construction, renovation, irrigation, sustainability, and more. Big or small, let the experts at David J. Frank handle the hard work for you. Find out more at DavidJFrank.com. Deer Defeat is an all-natural based animal repellent to keep deer and rabbits away from your valuable plants that is odorless after 30 minutes and dries clear. It creates a continuous, invisible shield to protect your plants. Works for 30 days through rain, snow, and freeze. Will not clog your sprayer. Apply to your property without environmental damage. You can spray directly onto your plants up to flowering, then apply around your plants to continue protection. No need to reapply. Money-back guarantee. To purchase, go to DeerDefeat.com and use coupon code RADIO to save 10% off your order.
Soil Diva Liquid Microbe Stimulant Spray improves the health of your plants you work hard to grow, stimulates the natural enzymes, and increases beneficial soil bacteria. Go to SoilDiva.net. SoilDiva.net. Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Jenny Gomes writes easy to understand, beginner friendly tutorials and recipes for those eager to try out homemade food and crafts. She takes old fashioned skills and makes them fit a busy modern life. When she's not caring for her two small children or teaching English online, she's busy writing her blog, The Domestic Wildflower, and she has a book coming out very soon, The Pressure Canning Cookbook. Welcome to the program, Jenny.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your day, not only to educate Holly and myself, but all of our listeners. And I will start with this because there can be confusion with this. Let's talk about the difference between pressure canning and water bath canning first.
Okay, great question. Water bath canning is appropriate for high acid recipes like jam, jelly, applesauce, and vegetable pickles. And pressure canners are appropriate for when you're canning low acid recipes, and that would be meats, beans, or plain vegetables. Those are all low acid foods, and because you don't have that acid of fruit to help create an environment inside the jar that would be inhospitable to spoilers, you need that extra high heat, that 240 degrees Fahrenheit that a pressure canner can achieve to kill any spoilers that might be present. So that's the difference. You need the pressure canner for low acid recipes.
And pressure canner is different than a pressure cooker.
That's correct. A pressure canner has a gauge on top that helps you to see how much pressure, how many pounds of pressure are being built up inside. And they are, a pressure canner can be used as a pressure cooker, but not the other way around.
So even, I just want to talk about this because I know this comes up sometimes, even like those Instapots, those are like considered pressure cookers, you cannot can in them.
That is correct. Some are marketed as being able to pressure can, but in testing done by cooperative extension offices, they failed to get hot enough, especially above sea level. So the recommendation from cooperative extension offices, which I support, is that pressure cookers should be used not for canning.
Fantastic. So I'm just curious how you got into canning. I didn't grow up canning, and I learned to can, I don't know, probably about 10 years ago or so. How did you get into canning?
I grew up on a cattle ranch in the really rural tip-top of California, and my mom and my grandma canned. We had a big garden, and most moms I know that I knew as a child, they also canned. And then as a grown-up, I was pregnant with my first child, and I was, as many expectant mothers do, I was starting to worry in advance about what types of foods my baby would eat. And I relearned how to can, and my first winter, I canned probably 100 jars of applesauce. And I learned a lot, and I saw that there was a lot of, there were good books out there, but there weren't any that were, I thought, geared towards a busy working mom or family. And most of the batch sizes were really large. And that is when I just started to realize that there wasn't a whole lot of information that was geared toward my type of life, like with recipes that could be completed within a couple hours, like during nap time. But that's how I got started.
Well, why is safe canning so important? Because I'm sure you've seen it, we've seen it, we've been kicked off groups for saying stuff. There are groups and people online that it doesn't matter if it's safe or not. They're asking how to do it, and you best tell them how, or you leave the group.
Right. So there is a culture of unsafe canning practice out there, and I just am a person that teaches practical, safe advice. So I think that it's just really great to remember that canning science or just information about food safety has been around for a really long time. Many of the canning recommendations that the cooperative extension offices and the USDA recommend have been around since the 60s and before. So, like, one recommendation is to use new canning lids. If you're using a regular ball-style two-piece metal lid, the recommendation has been, since the 1960s, to use new canning lids for canning just to create a reliable seal. And people sometimes like to say that I don't want the government telling me how to can, and that I just think is really misplaced idea. I think a lot of the recommendations have been around a long time, and they're based on really old, frankly, pretty boring food science.
Well, and there's people that don't like the government that still recommends a safe canning because they don't want to die.
Well, I think it doesn't even have to be quite as exciting. It can just be that you don't want to waste your time and have food that goes bad. You know, I think people really like, especially now that it's going to be an election year, I just am seeing more and more of that online, where if there's a sense of dissatisfaction with the government, which, I mean, my goodness, who's satisfied with the government? I don't think anyone is. Everybody is hoping for better, right? But there's just this sense that somehow canning recommendations are a reflection of something political, and I don't personally hold that idea. I think that the recommendations are very old, and there's something you can see with a microscope. They're just very basic food safety things, like the temperature at which that you want a low acid recipe to be processed at, over 240 degrees. That's really basic stuff.
And as food has changed, so has these recommendations in order to make it safe.
Sure, that's a great point. People always love to comment, on social media or tell me, remind me that their grandmother never added citric acid or another acidifying ingredient to her tomatoes. But the fact remains that tomatoes have been bred over the last 50 to 100 years to be less acidic. They've been bred to be sweeter and bigger and redder and rounder and more sliceable. They've been bred to travel a long ways in a semi-truck. So they have all become more alkaline and less acidic as a result.
So your book, Pressure Canning, the Pressure Canning Cookbook, Step-by-Step Recipes for Pantry Staples, Gut Healing Broth, Meat, Fish, and More, comes out next month in April. What was your inspiration for it, and which you had kind of talked about? And then tell us something that will encourage our listeners to pick up a copy.
Great question. I was inspired to write it because I found that there are some great pressure canning guides out there that don't necessarily help me figure out what's for supper. And I thought I wanted to write a pressure canning book that had safe guidance, good, clear directions. You mentioned really briefly that I'm a teacher, and I am an English teacher. And I thought the thing that I can add to the canning space is excellent directions, fit for a beginner. And I wanted to create a canon of recipes that were safe for pressure canning that would solve the question of what am I going to serve, tonight for supper. So that's what I hope that it brings to the canning space, is really good meal ideas, or at least sides ideas, that you could heat up really quickly and have a delicious meal essentially in a jar.
So if someone is unsure about canning something, let's say like meat, what suggestions do you have to encourage them to take that step if they've never done meat?
Sure. And it can seem really daunting. But I think that once I got comfortable pressure canning, I realized that there is, in some ways, it is easier to use a pressure canner because the instructions that come with your pressure canner, either you acquire one brand new or you get a used one from thrifting or from a friend or your mother-in-law. It is really important that you get a manual, and any pressure canner that you should use will have a manual available for free on the manufacturer's website. That's a great pro tip. So once you get the manual, read through it, and you'll see that every single step is very clearly outlined. Exactly how much water to put in the bottom of the pressure canner. Exactly how long to exhaust it, where you're filling the pot with pure steam. And it tells you every step that you're supposed to follow. So I think that what is encouraging about that is that there's very little room for the operator to make any decisions. You're just simply following the steps that are clearly outlined. The fun part, the thing that I can bring to the canning space, is the recipe ideas and the ideas for how to break the process into smaller chunks that you could fit into smaller windows of time.
Now, when one maybe acquires or inherits one of these pressure canners, is there a place in which they can go and get it checked to give them peace of mind that it's not going to blow the kitchen apart with
right.
making sure the seals are good and all that? How do they go about doing that?
That's a great question. Your best bet, if you are acquiring a used or older pressure canner, is to take it to a cooperative extension office near you, and they can offer specific guidance on sourcing replacement parts, finding a manual, or just checking the pressure gauge to ensure that it is measuring accurately. If you do not have a cooperative extension near you, and some of us don't, the next best thing is to have the gauge checked at a tire shop. Make friends with your local tire guy, and he can pressure check that gauge to make sure that it's accurate, which is really important. You're depending on that dial to be reading accurately. And if you're getting a used pressure canner that was in someone's garage, for example, it may not be accurate.
And depending on what altitude you are, that makes a big difference on where that gauge
right.
needs to be read as well.
Right.
So what is your best pressure canning safety tip that you would just tell anybody and everybody who is going to pressure can?
Sure. The best safety tip I have is I have really tried hard to ask every person that's ever tried to tell me the story of they know someone and, you know, the lid blew up. It's always some sort of story like that, and I've always tried to ask exactly what happened, and invariably, the problem was that the person was in a hurry, and they removed the lid before all the pressure had been released within. So it just goes back to just simply following the directions. If the directions for your particular pressure canner tell you to wait a certain amount of minutes or tell you to wait until a particular indicator on the lid is flush, like with my pressure canner, there's a device that is flat against the lid, and that indicates that there's no more pressure inside. I think that is the thing that ends up causing people a fright or injury or broken jars inside, is that they are in too big of a hurry to take the lid off. If I'm done with my pressure canning process, I usually just turn the stove off, slide that pot off of the burner, and then go do something else. I can go do a load of laundry. I can go do chores around the house. Come back in an hour. There's no reason to be in a rush to take those jars out. And if I had to, let's say, drive my kids to the school bus or something, or go pick them up, I would leave it in the pot. There's no harm. No terrible thing will happen if you leave it inside the pressure canner for an hour or so.
Now, there's all different sizes of pressure canners. Is there a beginner size that you would recommend for somebody who kind of wants to get into it but doesn't want to dive headfirst into a giant, massive pressure canner?
Yeah. I think the pressure canner that I have is the 16-quart Presto, which is a good quality pressure canner that's easy for a beginner to use. It is a smaller size. It holds, I think, 7 quarts, maybe 8, but I think 7 quarts for sure. And that is enough for my size family and my size kitchen, and it fit my budget when I purchased it. That said, Presto makes one larger size, and I believe they are the only brand that makes a pressure canner that works for an induction burner. All American is an American-made, excellent quality brand that offers the metal-to-metal seal with the metal lid clamping tightly to the pot itself. Its quality has a price point to match, and they have several sizes, and I believe now they even offer one of their sizes in several colors. So they have a very high quality product that's also user friendly, and they have a greater set of size options that you can choose from and color options.
Fantastic. Well, we really enjoyed having you on the program today, Jenny. Can you tell our listeners again how to get a hold of your book that's coming out and all of your great information and how they can get a hold of you?
Great. The Pressure Canning Cookbook will be out April 2nd of 2024, and it's available anywhere books are sold, including Amazon, and it will be available in Tractor Supply stores coming soon. I blog at thedomesticwildflower.com. I hang out on social media on Instagram, and my handle there is at @thedomesticwildflower. And I'm the co-host of a preserving podcast called Perfectly Preserved that you can listen to anywhere you get your podcasts.
Well, Jenny, thank you so much for the time you've offered Holly and myself and the education you provided all of our listeners. We thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And when we come back, it's your garden questions, our garden answers. You're tuned in to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Have a garden question? Give Joey and Holly a call now or anytime 24/7. Just dial 1-800-927-SHOW. If you can't get through, leave a message and they will call you back. Call now 1-800-927-SHOW.
Mantis tillers, the premium long-lasting gas-powered tillers, are the perfect solution for any garden. This Mantis machine is available with 2 or 4 cycle engines with a 19-inch or 16-inch tilling width. Your DIY companion in your garden and your lawn converts easily for edging, aerating, and more with optional attachments. Find details at mantis.com. Take the guesswork out of composting with the Aerobin 400 or smaller 200 for easy composting. The Aerobin mimics how nature decomposes waste. The Aerobin is easy to use. You prepare your balanced organic waste. Just open it up, drop it in, and close. After a short time, fertile compost is produced, which is easily accessed via the lower side door. The thermal insulation in the Aerobin conserves heat, leading to rapid breakdown of the biomass, and works efficiently year-round, even in cooler regions. There is no need to turn the biomass, and it is pet and rodent resistant. It has little odor and can kill annoying weeds and seeds. It is BPA-free. The Aerobin 400 or 200 comes with a reservoir at the bottom to collect the leachate. When diluted, makes for great compost tea liquid fertilizer. Aerobin composts kitchen and garden waste quickly. Easy to assemble with no special tools needed. The Aerobin makes composting rewarding and easy. Go to burpee.com or homedepot.com to purchase.
Straw bale gardening is all the rage. Get your bale started easily with the Bale Buster Straw Bale Conditioning Formula. This is the only product that has been specifically formulated for use in straw bale gardening. Each unit contains 250 million colony-forming units of trichoderma, fungi, and Bacillus bacteria, in addition to the fertilizer itself, produces fantastic results with a bountiful production of vegetable crops. Start with the best to get the best, traditional or organic formula. Take the guesswork out of conditioning your straw bale. Go to balebuster.com to find out more.
Wind River Chimes will always be the inspiring harmony. With a large selection and customization options, you will find the sound that soothes you. Visit windriverchimes.com to shop and find out more. Garden like a pro in 3 easy steps and receive customized fertilizer recommendations for your garden or lawn. Soil Savvy helps you determine what nutrients your plants need to thrive. Never again overapply nutrients they don't need. A patented process that makes you a smart gardener. To get your soil test kit, go to mysoilsavvy.com.
Rootmaker starts your plants off right and keeps them going through harvest. From their seed starting trays with an innovative design that air prunes the roots to their large variety of grow bags, 1 to 60 gallons, their products will provide you the harvest you've never seen before. Visit rootmaker.com. Use coupon code ROOT24 to save 15% off your order at rootmaker.com. That coupon code is ROOT24 to save 15% off your order at rootmaker.com. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Thank you for being with us today, taking time out of your day to allow us to be part of it. Time for garden questions and answers. If you've got a question, send it on over to gardentalkradio@gmail.com. That's gardentalkradio@gmail.com. Keep that in your memory. You can send a question anytime, gardentalkradio@gmail.com. Or you can give us a call 24/7, 365. If we can't get you on the air, leave a message. We'll call you back. That number is 1-800-927-SHOW. That's 1-800-927-7469. And by the way, all the as sponsors or the commercials you hear during the program, they are the companies that are paying for the airtime so you can hear us. And those who are offering coupon codes, if you missed it or not able to capture that information during the program, you can go to our parent website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and click on the money tab at the top of the page, and they're all listed for you. You just click on the image, takes you to their website. Just remember the coupon code and insert it at the time of purchase. All right, we got a couple of questions come in this week. We'll see how many we get through to the top of the hour.
All right. Hi, my ginger from October that I planted is green. Is it safe to eat? I know we can't eat green potatoes because of solanine. What should I do?
Well, when ginger is stored for long periods of time in cold environments, it can become less acidic, and there it can cause it to change the pigmentation inside of it to a bluish gray color. And even a green color, but it is safe to eat. So you can utilize that. And, or if it's like potatoes and they've sprouted, you can regrow it again if you are doing it in a situation in which, because, that the ginger is not going to freeze or get frost on, because ginger is a tropical plant and can be quite costly. So, if you are not familiar with ginger, it can have quite a little bite if you, get a good chunk of it when you eat it.
Yeah, it's quite potent. So here's another question. Yep. I want to start some seeds indoors. My question is, so I was wondering when to start my seeds. I was thinking a little closer to spring, my first year growing plants, and, you know, seeds have gotten so expensive.
Okay. This is a very, I'm going to give you a very generic answer because it depends on, I don't have the location of this individual, but for all of you are listening, whether you're listening in Boston, Denver, Kansas City, Southern Illinois, Chicago, or anywhere in between, it's based on your last average frost date. You can find that at your local extension office, or just go to your favorite search engine and type in my last average frost date and insert your zip code, and it will tell you. The USDA has changed some of the hardiness zones, which will adjust some of that. Does it adjust some of the frost dates? Somewhat.
Yeah, that's where the hardiness.
And a frost date is simply a guideline. It doesn't mean if today's your last frost date, tomorrow you can put it in the ground. That's not what that means. It's a guideline. So for, you know, I'm just going to ramble off some things here. Leeks, onions, celery, 10 to 12 weeks before your last average frost date. Brassicas, 4 to 6 weeks. Tomatoes, 6 to 8 weeks. Eggplant, ground cherry, 6 to 8 weeks, kind of give you a guideline. There's a lot of different charts based on where you're at and when to start them. But she said that plants, they have gotten very expensive. That is true. We rely on the garden center as a backup if we are not able to start plants indoors. Again, a plant can be $3, $5, $6, $8, $10 based on what you're looking at. Tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, you're looking at $6+ a plant. Romaine lettuce, $5+ for, you know, it's almost like it's cheaper to go buy the stuff, the actual produce, than it is to buy the plant to make the produce. But
yeah, I think you kind of just have to decide what you're going to eat, what you know, how much you want, and how particular you want to be about things. I think that makes all the difference. All right, so another question is,
what can I grow on my small back porch?
Well, this is dependent on what way your porch faces. If it's facing the north, you might not be able to grow as much things that require a lot of sun versus if it's facing the south or west because of the access to sunlight. So I would take that into consideration, but you can always grow things like leaves, like lettuce.
Leafy greens,
thank you. Anything that has, so there's like a little saying, if it's for the fruit or the root, you need full sun. If it's for the leaves, then you can just grow it in partial shade. So leafy greens are always a good porch option. If you do have a lot of sunlight, you can definitely grow a lot of things.
Our back porch faces west. Faces east.
Southeast.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a small porch, and we have grown cherry tomatoes. We've made it trellis with a container. We've grown pole beans. We've grown cucumbers. We've grown green beans in a railing. We've grown Swiss chard in a railing container. So there is we've grown peppers in Rootmaker grow bags. We've grown beets in Rootmaker grow bags. We've grown leaf lettuce in Rootmaker grow bags. You can use coupon code ROOT, R-O-O-T 24 to save 15% off your order at rootmaker.com. As long as you have an imagination, a lot of things can be grown on a porch or a patio or a deck, minus, let's say, pumpkins or corn or something very large footprint required, yeah. Or like corn takes a tremendous amount.
Like very viney.
Yeah, very viney. Now, corn, there's a container variety of corn, but that's a whole other story for another show. But there, you can do a lot in a very small area, as you can in the ground as well.
Absolutely. You can get creative and just do a little bit of research for what works for what direction your porch faces.
What, if anything, do I need to put in the bottom of my raised bed before I fill it?
Well, if it was up to me.
Okay. What is up to you? You're answering the question.
When we started our raised beds, I would have put some sort of weed barrier down. Personally,
we didn't know
cardboard.
I know people are like, cardboard has toxic and all the stuff that we've sucked in. You know,
yeah, I know, don't mean right. I would have put cardboard down because now we have a whole weed situation. Not saying that weeds couldn't grow through the cardboard, but I feel like it really helps smother them before you put down soil in a raised bed. But that's what a lot of people do, is they put down cardboard.
If you have gophers in the area or moles. Or voles, you want to put hardware cloth, which is a webbing, a metal mesh webbing underneath the raised bed, and then 6 inches on either side and beneath the soil grade so they can't burrow up and destroy your produce, your plants in your raised bed. Cardboard, yes, especially if you're in a very weedy situation. If you've got a really, really tall raised bed, let's say 24, 36 inches, you can put logs, decaying logs, in the base of that bed to absorb some of the ambient space so you're not utilizing all of that for expensive compost. Don't put trash, don't put cans, don't put styrofoam, don't put any of that stuff in the bottom of the raised bed. Natural material. Leaves, it's going to take a lot. They're going to decay really quick. Pine straw, same thing. Logs would be the thing if you're going to fill a tall raised bed. But a raised bed doesn't need to be any more than 10 inches at minimum. Ours is 12. I think ours is 12.
And I thought ours was 10.
Maybe they're 10. I haven't measured lately. maybe they shrunk.
Yeah.
But that's some advice there in which to help you get your garden off better. And we went with raised beds simply because of the weed problem. Now, like Holly said, we do have weeds in our raised bed. You're going to have that because we don't keep up with it as much as we should. But it is 1,000 times less weeds than we ever would have had if we continued to do ground gardening. We had a tremendous amount of weeds, and we would work the ground very diligently and remove the roots. And within 8 weeks, you couldn't tell that I had spent 40 or 60 hours in the garden doing this. So we invested in the materials to do raised beds, and it has greatly reduced the amount of weeds, though we still have weeds, but it also has increased the produce in which we've gotten out. We went from 1,800 square feet to about 650 square feet and have not the quantity of produce has not diminished. It has actually increased because of that soil we've brought in and being able to manage what we have much more effectively and efficiently.
Do you think it's increased? I feel like it's about the same, but maybe it has increased.
It hasn't decreased at all.
No, it has not decreased.
Going from 1,800 square feet to 650 is not decreased at all.
So what did we learn today?
With that being said, what did we learn today? Well, I learned that the top layer or topsoil is called a horizon. I thought it was just topsoil. That's what I thought it was always called, but it's a horizon.
That's the science name. I learned, and I guess it's more of an inspirational. I was more inspired by our guest to finally can meat. And Joey and I are going to do that with deer.
Venison.
And I think that just her talking about just finally pushed me over the.
And I reached out to a couple people in the outdoor world that I know can, and they're like, "Oh yeah, it tastes like roast beef. Yeah, it's great." So.
So we'll
pressure can now, not water bath, pressure can.
Right.
So what we learned today is brought to you by Honey Bee Healthy.
Whether you're a gardener, a bee hobbyist, or a professional beekeeper, Honey Bee Healthy Inc. has the products to help you maintain a healthy hive and thriving garden. For more information on how to use Honey Bee Healthy in your garden, visit honeybeehealthy.com.
Tune in next week to the program where segment one and segment two will be 10 plus garden tricks, techniques that we use that will make your garden a better garden this year, as well as host of the Beekeeping Today podcast, Jeff Ott will be with us, and we'll answer your garden questions. So until next week, for
Holly Baird,
I'm Joy Baird, and we will see you in the garden.